Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A.
Maybe the senator said it's a game of power. Yes, and maybe they're scared of black ghosts. But you ought to know after all this time, Bliss, and I hope you'll tell me sometimes. Anyway, boy, it was out there. You remember what it was, don't you? The occasion? It was another revival, wasn't it? Of course it was a revival, Bliss. But it was Juneteenth, too. We were celebrating emancipation and thanking God. Remember, it went on for 7 days. Juneteenth, the senator said. I had forgotten the word. You've forgotten lots of important things from those days, Bliss. I suppose so. But to learn some of the things I've learned, I had to forget some others. Do you still call it Juneteenth, Reverend Hickman? Is it still celebrated? Hickman looked at him with widened eyes, leaning forward as he grasped the arms of the chair. Do we still? Why, I should say we do. You don't think that because you left? Both, Bliss, because we haven't forgotten what it means. Even if sometimes folks try to make us believe it never happened, or that it was a mistake that it ever did. Juneteenth, the senator said, closing his eyes, his bandaged head resting beneath his hands. Words of emancipation didn't arrive until the middle of June, so they called it Juneteenth. So that was it. The night of Juneteenth celebration, his mind went on. The celebration of a gaudy illusion.
With his masterpiece, Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison left the world of American letters a singular and enduring legacy. Together with his essays and short stories, his great novel was widely thought to be the sum of his literary contribution. But Ralph Ellison labored on for decades on a second major novel, drafting and once recreating a vast manuscript that remained unfinished at his death. Now, that last great contribution of this original American artist has emerged. Through the artful editing of his literary executor, John Callahan, the reading public can now enjoy Juneteenth, a further exploration by Ralph Ellison into the themes of race, religion, politics, and the casting of the American mosaic. And my guest is John Callahan, Odell Professor of Humanities at Lewis and Clark College and the literary executor of Ralph Ellison. John, it's great to see you again.
Likewise, George. It's great to be back.
John, it's an extraordinary project, and I think maybe the most appropriate question to begin with is a question about method, because you had to work with thousands of pages of manuscript, notes, documents, and from them fashion a posthumous Ralph Ellison novel entitled Juneteenth. I know it's a very complicated process, but if I asked you how you did it, what your rationale was, how you would put this together, what would you tell me?
Well, I looked to see what was there, George. It's sort of like one of the things that Invisible Man says in Invisible Man. He's talking about the discovery of America by Columbus. He says, you know, he started out looking for the Indies, and he found another place. He found a new world, but in another place. And I suppose that my work is akin to that. I started out hoping that the book was finished, or all but finished, hoping that I'd find a huge manuscript with instructions from Ralph. This is the beginning, and the middle, and the end, and about this last sentence, I'm still having trouble, and don't worry much about it. Here's a draft of the last sentence. But I didn't find that. What I found was that Ralph kept spinning off, spiraling off in particularly the episodes of the subplots. Mm-hmm. The novel really has a heart of the novel, which is Juneteenth. It's the story of Reverend Hickman and his midwifing of the little boy,
right.
his raising of this little boy, seemingly a white child as a black child, the boy running off at adolescence, becoming a con man, a movie man, and then emerging as a racist United States senator, passing for white, his assassination, which Hickman tries unsuccessfully to prevent, and then the back and forth between the two men at the senator's bedside, right. ending, as Ellison always intended to end this novel, with the senator's death.
Mm-hmm.
That was the heart of the story, and Ellison attempted to enrich it by integrating a couple of subplots into this story. And it's the subplots that gave him fits and that that kept spiraling off instead of coming back
right.
you know, to the central action. They kept mm-hmm. going farther and farther afield.
Yeah.
And I realized at some point after 3 years pretty much of work on the novel that it wasn't going to work as the big, you know, saga that mm-hmm. Ralph wanted. It, you could say here are the fragments, but it wasn't going to work as a book. And in my stopping up short at that point, George, I said, by God, let me go back and look, because there is the heart of the story is here.
Mm-hmm. I want to go right into the heart of the book, and you've given us a very good capsule description of this story, which, of course, is set in the 1950s South, a young boy who appears white, raised by a black musician preacher named Hickman, a young man who himself is an evangelist as a kid, as you point out, becomes a filmmaker, later emerges as Adam Sunrader, a racist mm-hmm. New England senator, and maybe right. there's some significance there.
I think so.
Okay, let's go for it, John. What is the significance?
Well, I think
of
that? Ralph's point is that race is a function and an issue in American identity, not simply a matter of the Deep South. And hell, if you think about Ellison beginning this, conceiving it in the middle 50s, and working on it through the 60s, the emergence of George Wallace, who runs as a segregationist in northern primaries in 64 and does astonishingly well and comes back again in 68, comes back again in 72. And as I think Ellison was pretty prescient about the American psyche.
There are marvelous passages in this book, and I want to talk about language in a minute because it's one of the great Ellison contributions brought forth again in Juneteenth. But there are also marvelous passages here, among many others, that have to do with Oklahoma, the territory, and those themes. In addition to writing a great American novel, and he was the son of Oklahoma, was he also trying to produce an Oklahoma novel, a territories novel?
Well, I think so. It's interesting because I think there's very rich stuff about Oklahoma in this book. Much of it is indirect. It's reminiscence. In the some of the manuscripts that will be published in the scholarly edition, there's an Oklahoma section. The focus is more direct. I'm not sure it's as powerful, but it's there, and it's certainly of importance. And it's also important for me, anyway, to remember, became very important to me to remember how Ellison thought of Oklahoma. He once inscribed my copy of Going to the Territory, his 1986 book of essays, and I love the inscription, and I can't ever forget it. He inscribed it as follows: "For John Callahan, my friend, who knows that the territory is an ideal place, ever to be sought, ever to be missed, but always there." Mm-hmm. So the territory was with Oklahoma, and it was a metaphor for America. And for me, as I did this work, it was a metaphor for the novel.
Right.
An
right.
ideal place, always to be sought,
always
to be missed,
sought.
But always there. And the point is the palpability, it's there.
Always just beyond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it also needed to come to fruition
mm-hmm.
so that his work could be shared with everybody.
Is there an American search for the territory? I mean, should there be?
I think there is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the territory is internal. There's the territory of the human heart. And then there's the territory of the country as an ideal. Mm-hmm. And then the actual physical geographic territory, the day-to-day life in the country, which we have to be concerned about, and which Ellison said every last one of us is personally responsible for.
Do I overstate it, John Callahan, to think of this man as a literary patriot and prophet?
No. I think that's exactly what he was, a literary patriot. That's a wonderful way to put it. Yeah, there's a sense of there's a relationship in a way between the Latin words pater, father, and patria, country, or place. And I think Ralph was very much involved with that. He loved the country. He once wrote to me after I'd sent him a piece on his work in which I called him a patriotic writer. And it is in the 70s. You weren't supposed to do that, George, as you know that.
I remember
it was a bad word, patriotic. And he wrote back and he said, I'm glad you called me a patriotic writer. It's true I'm a patriotic writer. And then he went on to add, my problem has always been and is to affirm while resisting. A patriot has an obligation, as in the case of Tom Paine and Prince Hall and more lately Rosa Parks, to resist the injustices of the country, to call the country that he or she loves to account.
The man was a musician, too, wasn't
you
he?
Bet.
And this comes right in the prose, is it not?
Sure. And Henry Luce Gates has a wonderful essay review of Ellison and this book in a current issue of Time magazine. And he says that Ellison's great contribution was to bring African-American vernacular music, jazz, to literary form. And this book is a succession of riffs. I think that's why some people are having a little trouble with it. They're kind of unable to grant Ellison his form.
Yeah.
And it's a jazz book.
That's exactly right. And if you do grant him his form, if you understand it and relate to it, I want you to speak to us now of some of the cadences right in this book between Bliss and Hickman. I mean, there's wonderful dualities here. Bliss and Hickman, old and young, black and white, evangelists both, speaking in chant and response.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this kind of cadence. Is that one of the great richnesses of this book?
I think so. It's a lyrical triumph. I mean, it's a triumph of the American vernacular, and I think that Ellison is pushing it out in this book. I think in this book he does some things that he didn't do in Invisible Man, mm-hmm. and certainly you have the different idioms of both Hickman and Bliss, and each of these guys can go several ways. I mean, Hickman owes much, of course, to the tradition of the black church
right.
and the great sermonizers and the Bible. I dare say he also owes something to Mr. Shakespeare. And Bliss, Sun Raider, grown up as this politician, owes something to the classical oratorical tradition, and he equally owes something to the riff, and he owes something to the sermons and the great Negro preachers that he listened to when he was a child and he was on the platform with them.
Well, we get here, don't we, get the interconnected inspirations of the American idiom.
I absolutely.
Mean, we're all products of all of this.
We're all one.
Black and white really together.
That was Ellison's point. We're indivisible. Whether we like it or not, we're all one. And we better deal with it. Beneath the categories, on the lower frequencies, we're all Americans.
Love that. Love that lower frequencies, too.
Yeah.
John, let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is John Callahan, Odell Professor of Humanities at Lewis and Clark College and the literary executor of Ralph Ellison. Any work by Ralph Ellison, certainly any novel, is bound to be about identity at the very profound level. It's very easy for a reader, it was very easy for me, to think of Hickman as noble, which he certainly is in so many ways, having survived so much and done so much that is laudable, and Bliss as ignoble, you know, because he emerges eventually as a racist senator. Mm-hmm. But I suspect it may be more complicated than that, that Ellison's characters may have much more complexity than just this one's good and that one's bad.
I think you're right. And if you think about Hickman, yes, there's a nobility about him. And, of course, you think about the name, Ellison's playing around, a Hickman. He's a hick man, but he's not a hick. He's a provincial, but he's not a hick. And Sun Raider, who... it wasn't for nothing that Hickman loved this boy so much, and you see some of that yearning and that humanity in the senator. And also, I don't think Ralph lets Hickman off scot-free, as it were. After all, he puts little Bliss through some pretty tough paces.
Right.
He makes a performer out of him for his, and in a way it comes close to being a kind of spiritual or religious con game.
Without paying him his ice cream.
That's right, and he won't give him his ice cream. In mm-hmm. some ways, mm-hmm. Hickman has difficulty, as many fathers do, letting his foster son be a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that old little Bliss resents, even in his maturity as a senator. He says, damn it, you didn't give me my ice cream.
Right.
He wouldn't even give me the ice cream.
So and on what level do we owe sympathy to Bliss, though? Is it because of those kinds of deprivations, or is it some greater... Because that whole transition, that point where he runs away and he emerges eventually as the... And we'll talk about this in a minute, his cross-country odyssey as a filmmaker, and then his...
Mm-hmm.
What happens to him, and what makes him...
Well, that's one of the mysteries. I think there's some there's some self-loathing involved. I think Ellison is playing around with the terrible effects, not so much of race per se, but of the constructs, the meanings that get put upon race, have gotten put upon race in this country, particularly upon blackness in this country. You remember the scene in the where they go to the circus.
Yeah.
And Bliss sees the clown who's in blackface, and he's a little guy, and he's getting messed with by the bigger clowns, and surely there's an identification. And then when Bliss runs into the kind of midget in blackface later in the tent, he punches him and hits him, and he sees the blackness coming on. He's trying to get the blackness off of this midget. Well, surely Ellison is playing around. Say, Bliss is trying to remove his own blackness, which he, again, tries to do by passing, but can't do it.
I got a sense of it. Racism as a double-edged sword. I mean, you know, ultimately Bliss lying in that hospital bed, and he uses his own rhetoric, you know, to which is still beautiful as a senator, but now he's advancing a very kind of a cruel message. And he's paying a price for this racism, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, it kills him. And one of the things, again, that Ellison, I think it's hinted at, but Ellison never really works it out here. It's adumbrated and laid out more in some of the fragmentary material. But, of course, the guy who assassinates Senator Sunrader, no doubt you've figured out already, Severin, is his son.
That's right.
And he's conceived by Sunrader with the woman who's unnamed in Juneteenth. Elsewhere, Ellison names her Lavatrice, part Indian, part black, part white. She's a, you know, what does she represent? Among other things, Oklahoma, I think.
That's that idol.
That's right,
section,
the idol.
Yeah, which occurs, and this brings us to a very interesting point here, that occurs in that transitional period, it might be the phrase, where Bliss is crossing the country with two other gentlemen as filmmakers.
Right.
And he has this liaison with this lovely woman who is unnamed in this book, as you point out.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Uh-huh. And he's able to feel and express a certain tenderness at that point.
Yeah.
It's not unmixed with the imagery of love, the kind of false imagery of love and women and sexuality that he gets from the movies, of course, when he's still chasing after the figment of his imagination with reference to his mother.
Is that use of the movies also an Ellison comment on America? Because as far as I could fathom, these three men, Bliss, principal among them, are going town to town and seem to be enlisting town people in a kind of a film effort and appealing to their vanity to be in it. And that's, I mean, it sort of struck me as we Americans, this is our media, this is our medium, rather.
Yeah, well, there's all issues of transformation and representation get involved in that. And, of course, it's a black town.
Mm-hmm.
And movie man, Bliss grown up to be movie man, and the others, they said, well, we'll make a movie about these people. And again, it suggests something of the way that Bliss, movie man, Sunrider is a complex figure, because there's a rebel with him. There's a Jew, Karp, and then there's a southern white guy, Donaldson. And then there's Bliss, or movie man, and Donaldson just says, hey, you know, God, pickaninnies, and would, you know, just dress, how can we possibly dress up these coons as and revolutionaries? You know, we can't do it. You know, they're coons after all, and we got to make a great joke out of them. And Bliss shakes his finger at Don and says, we will do nothing of the kind. We're going to portray them as loyal and decent, hardworking Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, in a way, Bliss's loyalties on the lower frequencies are still present for these people who've raised him.
There is an awful lot of religion in this book. And, of course, it's a Christianity of an evangelical, rural, southern tradition in large part. I want you to tell me what that means, and particularly because I wish I'd counted the number of times, there were several times, I think, where I saw faith, hope, and charity repeated almost as a mantra.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ellison is playing with so many things here. When Bliss is a child, his part in the revival service, this miming of death and resurrection and therefore redemption, the key words are the same words that Christ uttered on the cross. Lord, Lord, why hast thou forsaken me? You know. And so this is the son, Bliss, asking the father, Hickman, this question. And when Sunrider is assassinated on the Senate floor, against his own will, he utters the words that he had sworn never to utter in the United States Senate because they would reveal his identity. And Ellison is just brilliant here. Lord, standard idiom, and then he modulates to Lord, the black idiom. So you get, Lord, Lord, why hast thou forsaken me? And then Hickman comes in from the balcony and responds, for thou hast forsaken me. In other words, you ran away. So you get these two guys acting out the drama of the crucifixion and the resurrection in this present context. It's dynamite.
It is dynamite. And those Hickman Bliss dialogues, I mean, are sort of throughout the book. The boy man as preacher, and then, as you point out just now, the Senate floor, that ultimate chime response, and then the hospital bed.
Yeah.
Where they're going, both in and out of consciousness and back and forth.
Well, an interesting thing you see is that Hickman raises Bliss, and is a kind of, we know about Bliss's mama.
Yeah.
We know she's a white woman, and we know that Hickman is a midwife who delivers the baby.
Mm-hmm. At great cost, we should add, because she has been responsible for alleging rape by Hickman's brother,
right,
who was lynched.
That's right. So Hickman wants to kill her and the baby. And by a succession of turns, that is unbelievable to people listening to us. It's only believable if you read the book and you realize Ellison gets away with it, by God. He pulls it off. So you have this, and you have the guy, you'd think the guy would be, he'd be in search of the father, whom he doesn't know. Instead, he searches for his mother, and yet the true drama is that he runs away from Hickman, who's his father, and then seeks him again at the point of death. And at times in his reveries, and this is what is compelling and attractive about Sunrider, he remembers Hickman and he says, Daddy Hickman, Daddy Hickman, the father, the true father, but black.
Yeah.
And he says, why didn't I embrace him? And why didn't, when I met this wonderful woman and made love to her, why didn't I say, here's where I'm going to stand in this state, in this new place, in this territory? But he says, having loved, I moved on, which is indeed a kind of American tragedy. I mean, this isn't the first book to detail that.
Exactly. Very well, American tragedy indeed. Why Juneteenth, John Callahan?
Well, of course, Juneteenth is the day that in June 19th, 1865, when the Union ship sailed into Galveston Harbor, and the commander of the ship told the weeping, cheering slaves that they were free. And wonderfully, the slaves themselves, in their vernacular, made up this lovely vernacular word, Juneteenth. They named the occasion with a lovely vernacular coinage. Why Juneteenth is the title? Ellison didn't leave a title for this book.
Right.
Called the Hickman novel and so on. And I knew there had to be a title. It had to be his words or word. And I made a list of about a dozen possibilities. And one day I was walking up the stairs in my house, and Juneteenth. That's it, Juneteenth.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that intuition, the choice made absolute rational sense to me because of the four excerpts Ellison published from this narrative during his lifetime. He named one Juneteenth. It's the middle of the narrative, the central stuff, and the central episode. And of course, Juneteenth, he is making of it not simply a historical occasion, but a metaphor for liberation.
Yeah. Well, that's the question right in itself. What kind of metaphor for liberation?
Well, Hickman says at one point there'll be a heap of Juneteenths to come before we're truly free.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody, you got to be free, and that's true of everybody. And Ellison's saying, hey. Mm-hmm. Americans, you better learn about Juneteenth and you better celebrate it if you want to advance toward your own freedom.
With underlining every one of you.
Every one of us. Mm-hmm. Every one of you, us.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That was his vision.
Yeah.
Nobody gets left off the hook with Ralph.
I would have loved to have known him, I guess. That's what all I can
man.
Say.
Wonderful.
Inevitably, John Callahan, as you, as the writer and an author and scholar that you are yourself, literary executor of Ralph Ellison and man of letters in your own right, knew this book was going to provoke a tremendous reaction, which has come forth and will come forth. What's your reaction to the reaction?
Well, it's all right. I mean, Ralph taught me a lot, and one of the things he he taught me. He talked about that. He said he talked to Irving Howe about this. He said there's another Negro tradition that stresses discipline in the face of hurt and pain. And I don't. He's talking about life and death stuff, indeed. But it's also in the conduct of your life. So you get criticized, and some of the criticism stings. At the same time, you say, well, hell, people say, well, God, why publish this book, Ellison, didn't finish it? And as if it's somehow going to tarnish, as if it's, say, for example, it tarnished Scott Fitzgerald's reputation, as if it tarnished the achievement of the Great Gatsby to have The Last Tycoon. I don't buy it, George.
As we conclude this conversation, now you alluded to this earlier, but I'd love for you to reestablish the point, because inevitably, and I think my whole hope for our talk today, of course, is that more and more people will read Juneteenth, as they should, and I think they will. But as they consider that and as they do that, they're going to have Invisible Man in mind. So restate, John, just what is the development between these two, or the lower frequencies upon which these two blend and join?
Well, Invisible Man ends with a kind of assertion in the form of a question that what Invisible Man has said in the course of his memoir and Ellison's novel is shared by the rest of us on the lower frequencies. And he poses it as a question. I think in Juneteenth, among other things, Ellison is acting that out in terms of Hickman and Bliss, who each have several voices and whose voices are interconnected with each other in several fashions. And if I might, George, I take this opportunity on your program, Dialogue, to express my gratitude, I think that of Mrs. Ellison's, to the Wilson Center for the opportunity that it gave me to spend a full year on this project, to come back in the summer of 97 when a real breakthrough occurred. And so there was a certain conviction that Ellison's work was important, and in perhaps a smaller way, a faith that this project was worthy of support, and I was worthy of support, and I'm very grateful to the Center for that.
Well, we're very grateful to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, John Callahan, so much.
Okay.
And thank you for Juneteenth.
You bet.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest was John Callahan, Odell Professor of Humanities at Lewis and Clark College and the literary executor of Ralph Ellison. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production assistants are Daniel Setlow and Miriam Brenly. Our recording engineer was Kirsten LaCour DeBelco. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.